Hi everyone, thanks for this episode of Michigan Times. In this episode we have a sensational guest, we have Craig Greiber. Craig is a former 2002 Los Angeles mayoral candidate and business executive. Craig is about to release his debut book, Chasing Normal, Growing Up, Letting Go, and Finding Joy in Being Different, which is a poignant memoir of one man's journey of trying to be like everyone else, only to realize that being himself was the only way forward in life. Welcome Craig, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. How's it all been going over there?
It's going well. I mean, when you don't start out to be an author and tell your story for the first time, it's a unique experience. You know, I'm not one of those people who grew up as a kid always saying, I want to grow up and be an author. This was a journey of a book that I wrote and never intended on publishing. And yet here we are. I, you know, as much as I've shared parts of my story, certainly as while I was running for mayor and as part of my career, putting it all unvarnished on paper, the truth out there is a scary experience. But that's the whole point of the book, is that we shouldn't be afraid from those scary experiences that are different and wild and crazy, even if they are.
Incredible. That's awesome. Tell me, how was the pandemic when it hit for you personally and professionally?
Yeah, I mean, professionally at the time, I was a senior executive at a marketing and strategy firm and overseeing and taking leadership roles with pandemic responses for some of the world's largest companies. So professionally, I was working 24 hours a day. But on a personal level, you know, I think the pandemic, for many people, people welcomed the opportunity to recenter themselves and to find themselves and that sort of thing. I'm a people person. I love being around people. I love being surrounded by people. And so that was incredibly difficult. You know, I think, I certainly within all the safety of all the protocols crafted a friend group where we all stuck together and strung together that got me through the pandemic. But between, you know, 20 hour workdays, and the isolation that I posed, it was a lot of self-reflection time that is not my forte.
Oh, that's cool. All right, let's just jump straight into it. Take us back. Tell me about your family life growing up, what it was like growing up, and I guess how that shaped you into the person you are now.
Yeah, certainly. Well, the book really gets, it is really all about that journey, right? I grew up in, if you imagine the poorest of poor places that you can imagine, like three steps more poor, right? It was the type of place where you can't afford shoes, where you're picking food in the wild because it's free, where you don't go grow a garden for vanity. You grow a garden because it's cheaper to buy a 39-cent pack of seeds than it is to, and wait 9 months than it is to go to the grocery store and buy vegetables you can't afford. It was incredibly difficult. And the people that I grew up with, the original family that I grew up with, were emotional terrorists, right? They were not good people. They just didn't have any interest in the world around them or in what we often talk about today of like how to raise kids, how to be a kind and loving family, or even, you know, you hear lots of stories in the movies about, well, I grew up really poor, but all we had was love and that's all we needed. that was not the case. There was no love and no love lost there. And so it was incredibly difficult. The type of place where I grew up, it wasn't, where do you go to college or what's next? You didn't even know what college was, right? Like these things were revelation. You didn't even know how to get out of poverty. When you're so deep in poverty that you don't even know how to get out, that's a problem. And only through a lot of hard work and blessings of others and people along the way giving me a helping hand did I find a way out after being abandoned as a teenager. You know, I never really had a childhood, you know, working full time from the time that for as long as I can remember, abandoned as a teenager, finding my way out, making my way to college, and then eventually adopted, by my family today, who are the most amazing, incredible people that I know. The family that I would have grown up with, had I had a choice. But, you know, it was certainly a long, long, hard road to get here. And when you grow up in that type of poverty and abandonment, you spend your life thinking about how do I show up, where do I show up? And that's where the book's title comes from, is I really tried to chase some version of what I thought people wanted me to be, what I thought I needed to be to get out of poverty, but that wasn't the answer.
Wow, that's a incredible and inspirational story. It's obviously where you are now. That's amazing. How did you get started in your career initially? And I guess, what has been the strength to get you there?
Yeah, my career, like my life, has been wild and crazy and haphazard. Right now, working in strategy and business and as an executive, it's not something you just apply for. There was never really a job that I held that I applied for. They didn't exist. It started because, in my youth, I was working in clothing stores and retail stores. That's what was available. And then when I got to college, I was an expert problem solver. The thing is, if I had the biggest problem in the world to solve growing up, which is how to find a way forward, how to live, how to find a way forward, get a job, figure out life when you've been abandoned. It's the toughest job I'd ever had. From that point, when you play that type of chess, in life, you learn to play that type of chess with everything. And so I became good at solving problems. I became good at when people would approach me and say, "Hey, I don't know what to do here. Like, how do we look at this?" It was really, that type of problem solving skill that led me from one person to the next. I would solve somebody's problems and they'd have a friend who had problems in a company. And then it went from consulting for individuals. My mentors, my old employers, when I got jobs in Hollywood solving problems with crazy talent, in advance of film releases, to now solving problems for some of the world's largest corporations, helping Verizon, which is the largest telecom company in the US, craft what their future looks like, trying to save, Meta, Facebook from itself. Some problems can't be solved. but it was really, it came back to that core learning as a kid, at solving the impossible problem of who I was and how I showed it, how to get out of where I was, gave me the ability and the skill set to be able to solve almost any problem that confronts me, and one that I'm good at today, and sort of became my job as well as my life.
That's brilliant. And how did you choose, I guess, specifically to become an executive? Like, is that something you always wanted to get? And when you solved the problem, obviously, I guess, going to college, you really got the momentum. Is that where you knew you wanted to head?
No, it ultimately came down to, it was funny. It came down to an old friend of mine, and the concept of bandwidth, right? There's a company here in the US, called DirecTV. It's a large satellite television provider. And they were launching their first original programming before there was Paramount Plus, HBO Max, before everybody had their own network. DirecTV had their own network and they didn't know how to launch a show. And a friend of mine who was running the network came to me and said, "I know you know how to solve this, fix it." So I did. And she said, "Well, you're going to need staff with you." Right. I was like, "Well, you're right. I do." So then I started hiring people and eventually built out a boutique agency, and then that our work and skill set was appealing enough that we merged into a larger company called Interpublic and Rogers and Cowan, which is one of the largest entertainment marketing firms in the United States. And it just became an issue of bandwidth and capacity. I didn't start out to say, "Oh, well, like, I want to grow up to be an executive." It became do good work and be a good person, and then find more people who want to do good work with you and be good people. And that's how that team sort of organically grew, and I organically reached the executive ranks.
Awesome. All right, tell me about running from there, LA, and what attracted, I guess, yourself towards that. Tell me about that.
Well, suffice to say, anyone who's listening to this can understand that politics in America is messed up. And I had never wanted to run for office. I had actually vowed that I would never run for office. I had advised different candidates in the past, and tried to help common sense folks carry the day, but certainly that was not my goal. And Los Angeles is one of the most messed up of all the messed up cities in America, if not the world, when it comes to political scandals. You know, it's not just, the recent stuff, with, you know, city council members indicted and under investigation and caught in leaked recordings and private dealings. I created a nonprofit in my problem solving skills. I said, "Okay, where can I solve something? What can I do that's going to be of help to the city?" And so I created a nonprofit that was focused on finding common sense and common ground, on trying to reduce the noise of everyone shouting at each other and find where we could agree. And through thousands of meetings and interviews and meeting with thousands of people, everyone was thrilled by the mission, but it was very clear that at that time, there wasn't a common sense candidate in the mayor's race. And for the second largest city in America to be left to extremist candidates, extremist corrupt candidates just fighting each other, didn't make sense. And so ultimately, I listened to the people around me who were encouraging me and decided to, it was the right time and the right place and the right message to put common sense solutions forward. And I'm proud, even though I didn't carry forward in that race, I'm proud that my policies are the policies that inform the candidates across all of the races. The candidates who are likely to win in many of the races carry those policies forward. And for me, that's what it was always about. How do I put these solutions in place? And I'm proud to have friends and colleagues and folks that I've become close with who are now elected officials really carry those policies forward from my campaign.
Is politics something you want to pursue in the future as well? Like, do you want to rerun or go down that road again?
It is not on my vision board for the future. My contributions to fixing America will be through a philanthropic effort and through private enterprise and through helping others who really want to find their way forward in the political arena. I want to help lots of folks get there. Absolutely. I want to help the right people get into office, but I don't think that's going to be me.
What was the process? And I guess, you know, I find it interesting in the experiences of running. Like, what was that like?
Well, the most, you know, a lot of people talk about the fact that the campaigns are grueling and they can be long days. But the part that was most candidates hate that I loved was being out there every single day, talking to people, engaging with people, hearing their complaints, hearing their joys, inspiring people. People I had never met who were inspired to give their all to my campaign. That was thrilling. And I had no problem going out there and spending my days in that format. I think the other half of that is that Los Angeles is an incredibly corrupt city, independently ranked as the number one most corrupt city in America. And to see a city and a system that is built to reject an outsider really go to town to try to do that was incredibly painful and difficult. You know, the editor from the largest paper, the only newspaper, which is a real large newspaper in Los Angeles, Los Angeles Times, having an editor from the LA Times say, "We're not going to cover you because even though your policies are good policies, even though you're a legitimate candidate, when people hear about you, they like you, and that's a problem for us." That's corruption. You know, like that's not journalism, that's corruption. And to have debate organizers say, "We're not concerned about the candidate talking about abolish the police or the candidate talking about the realtor from the valley. We're concerned about you because you're smart, you're charismatic, and you're willing to call people out. So we're not going to include you because it's dangerous." That's corruption. That was the really difficult part because I spent my life trying to do the right thing, trying to be there for people and to see people who were so bent on the selfish nature of who they were and what they wanted to preserve was incredibly heartbreaking and challenging. It didn't stop me from fighting, but it was definitely one of those things where I realized just how large that wall is.
Wow, that's great insights. And I can tell you're a politician the way you articulate stuff. So, you know, you've definitely in the future got the ability, that's for sure. Well, how would you describe your political views? I understand you're independent. Or you're running independent, but where do you stand on the political side or spectrum?
I am a straight down the middle of the line centrist, right? In the U.S., right? Like, I think we have both parties in the U.S., are controlled by the extremes on, you know, you've got the far left and the far right, and I think they're both wrong. I think the vast majority of Americans, live in the middle of the political spectrum. They live with, okay, well, how do I get my food, my clothing? How am I building a better life and a better world for my kids? I don't think there's this extremism. I think it's just what's controlling major parties. So I really tried down that middle in terms of really focusing on what it means to bring common sense forward. And that's, you know, that's saying, okay, we don't just keep adding money to the coffers to do things. You know, the taxes are and revenue are double what they were 10 years ago in Los Angeles, but the population hasn't changed. Anyone with common sense can tell you that means that we're taxing folks to death. And that's not a liberal or conservative point of view. It's just a fact, right? And the fact is that our homelessness policies have failed and we can see it on our streets, right? So it's not a liberal or conservative point of view. It's just a fact. The answer is now, where can I get everybody in a room and focus on what we agree on rather than what separates us? because it is much easier to build out when you find common footing than it is just to shout at each other about things that you don't even need to get to.
Well, that's really enlightening. Alright, tell me actually, what's the best advice you've ever received?
Oh. The best advice. I mean, I am lucky because, you know, being abandoned as a teenager, I didn't really have parents to give me great advice, and what was around me wasn't the world's best. So it certainly was really the result of mentors who came along the way. And, you know, in law school, when I was embroiled in controversy that I cover in the book, once again, trying to do the right thing, around corruption and malfeasance and folks who are cheating and lying. And a professor, you know, yanked me out of a very difficult situation. And he said to me, if you keep focusing on the small stuff, if you keep getting your feet tangled in the weeds, you're never going to get where you want to go. I think far too often we are pulled in so many directions every day, about, well, what can we do? And what do I have to do today? And this crisis and this fire in front of me, we don't think about the big picture of the world around us. And the more that we do that, the better off that we are. And so I really try to always keep in mind the big picture. What, not the weeds, not getting tangled in the weeds, but what do we need to do tomorrow and the day after to craft the world that we want instead of just responding to it? And that's probably the best advice that I ever got is don't get caught in the weeds.
Great advice. And what would be the best advice you would give somebody? Well, somebody that is aspiring to be you or have come from a situation like yourself. What advice would you give them?
It's really the message of the book itself, which is we are told every single day to be a certain way, to do a certain thing. You know, even the motivational speakers who talk about their hard knocks life and how they grew up, they're being paid $1 million to show up to an appearance. They don't have a hard knocks life anymore. We keep saying there's this padded version of reality that is not true, right? We keep chasing some version of normal that's created by influencers and celebrities. And so my advice to everybody is to stop doing that, is to just figure out what makes you happy, what brings you joy, what puts good into the world, what do you do well, and to really lean into that. It took me 20 years to figure that out, 20 years to stop chasing everybody else's idea of what I should be. So my hope is that it takes a little less time for everybody else to stop focusing on the celebrities of the world and start focusing on what they want and what makes them happy.
Great. All right, let's jump into the book. That's amazing. Chasing Normal, Growing Up, Letting Go, and Finding Joy in Being Different. Talk to me about that and the meat behind it.
Yeah, I mean, in that vein, I had spent so long trying to be like everybody else. Growing up poor, you look around and you're like, well, these people seem to be happy. I should try to replicate what they're doing to be happy. Only to realize that I was different from them. And frankly, we're all so different from each other, but we keep getting painted into these corners. And so the joy came from finding the release of saying, all right, I'm different and so is everyone else. It turns out that everybody is just trying to fake it till they make it. And when if we all just stop for a second, life becomes a lot simpler if you focus on who you are. And I think that's what that message of the book can be. That, and in, the book is a series of stories that really illustrate that. It's not any one moment in my life. It's not, you know, it's not on this day this happened and this day this happened. It's a series of experiences where I learned I thought I wanted to be like others, and instead I realized who I was and what I could be, and really leaned into that. And the book really finishes with that revelation that you can choose who you want to be without having to respond to all the pressures and demands from everyone else.
Right. What inspired, or where did the thought come, or where did the opportunity come to write the book? Like, where did that come from?
Yeah, certainly. I had never intended on, like I said, on writing a memoir. I wrote this for myself. I was reading another memoir several years ago out east by an author named John Glenn. And it really was the story of one summer in his lifetime that was pretty seminal in determining who he was and in embracing himself. And I thought, well, I wonder how I got where I am, and thought I'd write down a short story. And then one short story turned into two, and then it turned into a through line, but it was for me. It wasn't any, for anyone else. It wasn't for any other purpose other than to think about how I ended up where I am in life. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, a friend of mine said, hey, I know this book agent, you should probably talk to him. And he read the book and loved it. And next thing you know, he had sold it to Post Hill Press, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. And here we are today. But it didn't start out that way. It was for me. It was a cathartic exercise to think about who I am and what I wanted to be in the world. So it certainly has been a journey to embrace that element of it.
That's really impressive. For the listeners, what part of the book is your favorite that you would recommend, you know, skipping pages or whatever, to jump to? That really, that is your favorite part.
Yeah, I think for me, my favorite, the book is written so you can easily read a chapter. There are 9 pages and they're standalone stories. You can literally just flip anywhere. My favorite one, is different than where I would tell people to stop. My favorite is the chapter that opens part 2, which is called The Mom, which is how I met my parents, who adopted me as an adult, who are just the most incredible human beings. My favorite because they're the people I dedicate the book to. They're the people who make my life today possible, who've given me love and safe harbor in life. But if I were to tell somebody to dive in, I think there's probably 2 chapters that really, really are impactful, which is, Red Boots, which is about the first time that you make someone feel special, the first time that you matter to someone, and then A First Kiss, which is something we can all relate to, which is the first time that you feel love and have your heart broken.
Tremendous. That is tremendous. And is being an author something you want to go into the future as well? So is there other books in the horizon, or is that something you wanted to pursue?
It wasn't something I started out wanting to pursue, but I have a lot of stories and apparently a lot of stories to tell that people find interesting and entertaining. So I'm excited to see where the next book takes me. This book cuts out when I turn about 26. I'm 40 now, so I've got 14 years to make up for, and a whole lot of experiences that I don't cover. My time in the entertainment industry, it could be a book or two in and of itself, working for Hollywood studios and the chaos and craziness there. So certainly I think there's probably another book or two in the future, after we get through this one.
That's amazing. What motivates you daily?
Really for me, it's the thought process of how do we leave the world a better place? I am obsessively focused, often a little too much at times, on how we do something that makes the world a better place for those who come after us. No one should have to go through what I went through. So anything I can do that's going to prevent one more person from having to go through it, I'm all for it.
Cool. Great. If you look back in a positive light, what are the best memories you can recall, to your point now? What are your best memories you have?
My favorite memories are those with my family, not the people I grew up with, but my family today. When I think about every Sunday, I go see my parents and we sit and open a bottle of red wine together and just talk. It's simple. It doesn't require celebrityness. It doesn't require fanciness. It doesn't require stories or movies. It's just talking to my parents. It's those Sundays are my favorite. You know, I wouldn't trade that for the world. And I've done a lot of incredible things working with folks like Kobe Bryant and companies like Facebook and Verizon. And I've accomplished a lot of things that I think a lot of people would never have thought possible. But those moments at home with my family, those are my favorite. And they don't need a book about them. They're just the best moments.
That's true. You obviously, you work very hard and obviously got your hand in a few pies. What are your passions and hobbies aside from that? Like, if you got downtime, what do you like to do?
I will always choose spending time with friends over everything else. And some people are like, oh, like to garden or on a hike or whatever else. And my response is, what do my friends like to do? Because I'll take spending time with them. Now, I'm not a big hiker. It's a thing in LA. People like to hike. It's not my thing. But if my friends want to go on a hike, sure, we'll do it. Game nights, places where you just hang out and talk, and eat and drink and play games. Like those, that I love to do. I'm a voracious reader. I will devour every book, in my presence and every newspaper that I can find and every element of news. I find the most esoteric articles interesting. I'll read about tree frogs in Brazil and everything in between. Certainly that element, but it's spending time with friends, it's reading, and when I can, exploring the world around me. I grew up in the most, sheltered environment. So anytime that I can explore the world around me and find new places, cultures, travel to see places that are different from where I live, I'll take that opportunity because I'll never stop wanting to look beyond the walls around me to see and learn more about how other people live and what I can learn from them.
Awesome. Have you done much traveling? Like, have you done much international traveling? And even better, where's your favorite places to travel? What place to travel to?
Yeah. So I have, both for work and for pleasure. I used to travel a lot for work. I'd be on a plane 200 days a year. So certainly I've done my fair share of Asia and South America and North America and Europe. Haven't hit a whole lot up of Africa yet, but did obsessed with history, so therefore obsessed with Egypt, and that was a phenomenal trip. But my favorite place in the entire world to visit is an estate outside Windsor in Great Britain called Cowarth Park. It is a country estate where you can just go horseback riding for hours on end, and it's casual, easy, beautiful. Everybody knows your name. Everybody just is friendly, and it's just, countryside for days. It's just beautiful, casual, and I love horseback riding. It's a very cathartic exercise for me. I find it so insanely difficult that it's impossible to think about anything else, so it's relaxing. Only I would think that's relaxing, but I do. So I would go horseback riding any day of the week if my choice, and at Cowarth Park if I was allowed to go anywhere else.
It's extraordinary. All right, tell me, if you were 18 again and you could go back in time and change anything, personally or professionally, what would you change?
I think about if I had known a little bit more about how the world works, like jobs that were available, things like that would have been helpful, right? I didn't know what investment banking was when I was a kid. I didn't know what careers were. The best you could hope is to be the manager of a rental car store, right? But I don't know that I'd go back and change it. It's been a hard, hard row, in every step of the way. But I think what I've learned in writing this book, what I've learned from this book, is that if I were to change that, there's a risk that I would be something other than who I am today. And learning to embrace who I am, learning to embrace what I'm growing into, what we all continue to grow into, is the point. And so if I'm going to go back and rewrite history, I think we all learn from the movies, tampering with history has a price, but maybe a little bit more education about how the world worked, but I don't know that I would change anything.
That's really inspiring. You're an inspiration to many. Obviously where you come from. So yeah, mate, your journey's incredible. I can't say anything more words because it's just incredible. Your journey. Craig, thanks for coming to the podcast. I do appreciate it. I wish you all the very best in all your future endeavors. And yeah, you've done incredible.
Thank you. If this book helps one person to be themselves a little bit more, then I will be happy. So thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it.